compared to all the weather related events, extreme heat is the deadliest, but it's also mo the most invisible for the cities. So the design community needs to sort of work together with other professions. It cannot work in its isolation, to bring this conversation to the forefront and create awareness of the issue.
June 2021 was the hottest June on record for the United States, and no one felt that heat more than residents of highly developed neighborhoods with an abundance of asphalt and concrete and little natural shade. These warmer areas are called urban heat islands, and they are getting increasingly hotter due to global warming. I'm Therese Fitzgerald, Executive Editor of Commercial Property Executive. Welcome back to Sustainability Street, our podcast on the intersection of commercial real estate and the world we live in. In this episode, we zero in on the urban heat island effect, its causes, its impacts, and what the design and development communities are doing to lower the temperature in these areas. Let's get started. The reason that urban heat islands are hotter than surrounding areas is that buildings, parking lots, sidewalks, and roads absorb heat during the day and remit it into the atmosphere in the afternoon and evening. According to the EPA, daytime temperatures in urban heat islands can be 1 to 7 degrees higher than temperatures in outlying greener areas. In the evening, urban heat islands can be 2 to 5 degrees hotter. But there is another distinct characteristic of urban heat islands. They tend to be inhabited by lower income people and people of color, making them more vulnerable to heat-related illnesses and deaths. The urban heat island effect's disproportionate impact on underserved communities is a worldwide phenomenon. But in the United States, economists and scientists trace the heat island effect back to redlining, a discriminatory practice that originated during the Roosevelt administration. A quick history lesson on redlining. Beginning in 1935, the Federal Housing Administration sent assessors into 250 cities around the country to rate neighborhoods from A to D based on their safety for insuring home mortgages. The best neighborhoods, which happened to be inhabited by white people and had more natural landscapes, received an A rating and were outlined in green on the map. The neighborhoods deemed least safe for investment, which were inhabited mostly by people of color and contained a lot of man-made structures, were given a D rating or a red box on the map, thus the term redlining. Redlining not only resulted in reducing the amount of investment and wealth generation that would occur in the redlined neighborhoods, it confined people to those neighborhoods. Because if you lived in a redlined neighborhood, you couldn't get a mortgage that would allow you to move to a greenlined neighborhood.
Almost everything you can think of in the form of climate risk, as well as socioeconomic inequality, you know, can be traced in large part back to this practice of redlining in the 1930s and 1940s.
That's Dr. Jeremy Hoffman, chief scientist at the Science Museum of Virginia and a member of the affiliate faculty in the L. Douglas Wilder School of Government and Public Affairs and the Center for Environmental Studies at Virginia Commonwealth University. Hoffman's influential work on the heat island effect and its relationship to redlining began 4 years ago with a community science initiative to measure the air temperature in various parts of Richmond, Virginia during a July heat wave. The results showed that at the exact same time, on the exact same day, there was a 16 degree Fahrenheit difference between the warmest and coolest places of the city. With the help of Professor Vivek Chandas and his team at Portland State University, Hoffman mapped the hotspots and found a direct correlation between the elevated heat and land uses. Areas with extensive amounts of impervious surfaces tended to be hotter than areas where there was more tree canopy. That's the urban heat island effect.
Another interesting observation, and something that is not particularly unique to our study in Richmond, was that we found that primarily lower income and communities of color were tended to live in these areas of the city that were much hotter than other parts, which the cooler areas tended to be much more wealthy, predominantly white communities.
Hoffman wanted to know why this was, and he got his answer through the work of Professor Robert Nelson at the University of Richmond. Nelson had mapped America's formerly redlined neighborhoods and found a link between the boundaries of those formerly redlined neighborhoods and the boundaries of neighborhoods that struggle economically today. Other community-based studies in the city of Richmond at the same time were also showing that there was a correspondence between formerly redlined communities and food deserts and between formerly redlined communities and life expectancy. Being a climate scientist, Hoffman then wondered if there was a connection between the legacy of redlining and extreme heat and other climate stressors.
So using satellite imagery that can basically see the temperature of the ground from space in all of the cities that were redlined in the mapping and available in the mapping inequality database, we asked the question, you know, are these patterns of formerly redlined areas being warmer, how ubiquitous is that? We found, you know, 94% of the cities that had been redlined showed this incremental warming throughout the grade changes. So the formerly green lined or A rated areas remain significantly cooler than their redlined neighbors, to the tune of about like 5 degrees Fahrenheit across the country. That's much larger than even the expected warming due to climate change itself. So quickly, we can see how this urban design amplification of heat plus climate change further exacerbates the precarity that these individuals and residents already experience in their day-to-day lives.
Follow-up studies published over the past year have confirmed Hoffman's observations about heat islands and also linked redlining and poor air quality. Oh, and what's more, formerly redlined areas are also at greater risk for flooding, which is being further exacerbated by extreme precipitation events.
This redlining thing, I don't necessarily mean to suggest that it created these environmental differences. The descriptions that were used to describe the land, even at that time, said that the formerly redlined areas were, you know, heavily paved, hot, they had odors, manufacturing, whereas the formerly green-lined areas were described as wooded and shady and cool. So even at that time in the 1930s and 40s, this environmental disparity existed. Mm-hmm. But what I suggest is that this redlining practice locked it into place. It made it lawful for these differences to remain and get worse because of the highway system and other forms of disinvestment that occurred in the decades afterward.
So how do we lower the heat for those that feel it the most? First, we can plant more trees. Trees provide shade, deflect radiation from the sun, and release moisture into the air. They also act as natural air filters, capturing some of the particles that may pollute the air and make us sick. In Richmond, Groundwork RVA, a teen workforce nonprofit, and the city of Richmond have been using Hoffman's heat island map to plant hundreds of trees since 2017.
Trees are, you know, nature's air conditioner, but they do take a long time to become really efficient air conditioners. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I think about trees as a solution, I'm really imagining a forest that I probably won't be able to really experience. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I think it's really important for us to invest in our urban forest.
Restoring the natural landscape is one solution, but it can be a long-term one, and not every ground can support large shade trees. Therefore, urban planners, architects, and developers tackling this issue find that what's most effective is a mix of solutions tailored to the individual affected neighborhoods.
There is no one-size-fits-all, or there is no singular solution that solves the problem of urban heat island. That is, if you simply deploy a shade in some location, that doesn't mean that you're going to get the kind of comfort and reduction in urban heat that you want. You really have to deploy a multiplicity of elements together in the right combination to get at the problem.
That's Kishore Varanasi, principal and director of urban design at CBT Architects. He works globally on city planning and public spaces with an emphasis on the impacts of climate and human comfort. I spoke with Varanasi about the firm's work in Abu Dhabi, where the air temperature alone can reach 110 to 115 degrees Fahrenheit.
We all know that air temperature is not the urban heat island effect. That 110, 115 is felt differently in a countryside versus in the city. That's what we call as the urban heat. So you can imagine how much harder it can feel given the elements that we have put in place consciously or unconsciously in the cities, which are the streets, the asphalt, the automobiles, the buildings, all of which are radiating and re-emanating the heat that is gained from the sun into the space in between. So it gets, you know, 10 or 15 degrees hotter than the countryside beyond that.
In Abu Dhabi, CBT is the architect for phase two of Masdar City, a new city intended to be a sustainable urban community and innovation hub.
At Masdar, it is a low carbon city. It is trying to really understand how to really look at a different future for hot climates as we are building cities. It's an interesting and very fruitful experiment from that perspective. The difference is that, as we are planning and designing the city from scratch, you have control over every element from design to implementation. What that means is you can really understand where the sun is moving, how the wind is moving, and you can design the orientation of the buildings, the public spaces, and how the buildings and public spaces come together in a way to improve both sustainability and reduce the urban heat island effect.
Subsequently, the firm brought that thinking and learning into the existing city of Abu Dhabi. CBT piloted three multi-layered solutions for three different locations: a high-density neighborhood, a low-density neighborhood, and an intersection where pedestrians or bikers wait for the light to change. For the two neighborhoods, they customized cool zones or pocket parks. For the intersection, they created a cool path.
We thought about shading as a primary element of protection from the sun and creating comfort. But in addition to that, we used vertical walls to channel winds. We used native landscape to create comfort and evaporation into the space. We also used the materials in the right way to work with the three elements that I just mentioned to all in all create this microclimate where we can reduce the heat in these spaces and in turn reduce the heat in the urban environment.
In the United States, Varanasi said, there are multiple examples of extreme heat solutions that are missing the mark because they are singular approaches. In Los Angeles, for example, the city has painted a number of streets with a grayish white reflective paint. The solution works in part because the streets deflect the heat rather than retain it, and that makes the air cool at night. But during the day, the sun's radiation is reflecting immediately from the street, making people feel hotter, Varanasi said.
Similarly, places like San Antonio, for example, along the Riverwalk, deploy misting systems. I've seen this many times that the misting systems are attached to the canopies. It's very much holding an air conditioner in a hot sun if you do that. You have to place misting systems in shade close to people. If you don't shade and do the other layers and keep it close to the people, the misting doesn't do its job.
When designing mitigation solutions, it is important for urban planners and designers to remember that they are designing solutions for the human condition, Varanasi said. Therefore, in order to bring relief, it is essential to understand the unique heat stressors for each location, as well as the patterns of movement and the patterns of rest. As with other environmental justice issues, meaningful change for residents of heat islands requires multiple professionals in the public and private sectors working together.
Compared to all the weather related events. Extreme heat is the deadliest, but it's also the most invisible for the cities. So the design community needs to sort of work together with other professions. It cannot work in its isolation to bring this conversation to the forefront and create awareness of the issue.
That's Devanshi Purohit. She is an associate principal at CBT and also works on large-scale urban design and master planning projects with a special focus on climate change and resiliency in the built environment. She worked closely with Varanasi on the Abu Dhabi projects. Purohit is also a frequent speaker on the topic of heat island effect and has served on a number of forums and committees both here and abroad. 2 years ago, for example, she was invited to attend a 10-day workshop in Denmark to devise urban heat island solutions for the cities of Copenhagen and Frederiksberg. She also co-chairs the Committee on Resilient Environments at the Boston Society of Architects and is involved in the Climate Committee at the Urban Land Institute.
We, as a community, have an obligation that we share our sort of findings, whether it be research, design techniques, or strategies amongst the community, but also across the globe. There are times when some of these strategies and solutions are universal, but then how do we sort of learn from different cities and then make them more local and contextual to a particular community? So knowledge sharing is going to be very key to innovation and improvement in climate issues.
A key way to understand the different ways that communities feel heat, Purohit said, is to refer to the CDC ATSDR Social Vulnerability Index, as well as the growing number of local heat island maps.
We need to consider and embed these indicators into sort of our design thinking and our site selection process and where we are doing these interventions. And then our design solutions also need to be contextual to the specific issues that, you know, our particular community might be facing.
As an urban office and mixed-use real estate developer, Kilroy Realty is mindful of the extreme heat, lack of biophilia, and other environmental challenges facing the residents of the West Coast cities it operates in. To help lower the heat and increase biodiversity, it emphasizes greenery on the roofs of their buildings and their plaza spaces. The plants are typically native to the area in order to attract pollinators, and drought resistant, so they require little water or maintenance. Jasmine Lomax is Manager Sustainability and Corporate Social Responsibility at Kilroy.
Whenever we have a new development project going up, we make sure that we have pretty much 24-hour communication with the community to make sure like any concerns, questions, complaints get addressed immediately. Mm-hmm. And then also as part of our process, to make sure that the final development, again, like isn't harmful for that community, and just having that dialogue going back in the design phase before we even develop in an area is really important to us.
Kilroy is furthering its knowledge and advocacy on the heat island effect, as well as other environmental justice issues, by participating in the NAACP's Centering Equity on Sustainable Buildings initiative. The group was organized to ensure that underserved communities have a voice and benefit from sustainability measures.
Since buildings are such an integral part of our everyday, it's really important that everyone is included in those conversations, especially communities that suffer the most from the negative repercussions of climate change and global warming.
CPE will keep you informed on creative solutions to the heat island effect through our stories on individual firms and our coverage of the industry events where these ideas are exchanged. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, feel free to reach out to me at therese.fitzgerald@cpe-mhn.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll meet you next time on Sustainability Street. Bye for now.